Hey there, friends. Ezra here. Ray and I want to wish you all a happy 2025. I want to thank everyone who's listened this past year through this final episode of our first season. Really excited about this conversation that we recorded with Professor Tariq Masood of the Harvard Kennedy School. Thankful to him. This is a longer conversation that we had and decided to keep it as one integrated conversation. And now here we go ahead with the concluding episode of our first season of Outsider Insider.
Ezra.
Hey, Ray.
Why are we here today?
Excellent question, Ray. So we are hosting our first guest outside of MIT, special guest, Tariq Masood of the Harvard Kennedy School, to our podcast. Tariq is one of the leading scholars in the world on democratic development and specifically political development in Arab and Muslim majority countries. Tariq is the Ford Foundation Professor of Democracy and Governance at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government.
You know, ever since we started this podcast, this Outsider Insider podcast, we've been looking for some brave souls to join us, you know, to share this conversation with us. And, you know, we started looking up the river, and some of our colleagues suggested a few people. And when we heard about Tariq, we're like, this is the guy. Right? And then we met him. And I think we had a separated birth type experience with Tariq, and that we found someone at Harvard who was doing, let's just say, even better job of what we were hoping to do with the Outsider Insider podcast.
With his Middle East Dialogue Series.
The Middle East Dialogue Series. And let's think seriously about how we can build boundary-spanning relationships to have difficult conversations around complex, often intractable issues. And so, Tariq, you're here with us today.
Wow. Well, first of all, let me just thank you both gentlemen for inviting me to join this really important enterprise. I mean, I've listened to several of the episodes, and I just find what you guys are doing entirely laudable. And so it's a great, great honor to be with you.
Tariq, we have just a few ground rules.
Yeah.
And you can't have more than three syllables in the word because I have a limited vocabulary.
So do I.
It's right at the border, okay?
Sorry. What you guys are doing is great. So basically, this enterprise was after October 7th, I started putting together panel discussions on what had happened and the possible ways forward. And these panel discussions were very well attended on campus. But I was dissatisfied with them for a number of reasons. The first was that we never really got to dive as deeply as I wanted to into the ideas of any of our speakers. You have like 90 minutes maximum for a panel. You've got four people on that panel. You have to have time for questions. There's an emphasis also on civility. And so I felt we were having good conversations, but they were surface level conversations. So we never got to dive deeply, question people's assumptions, even their facts. And so I made the decision that in the spring semester, instead of convening panels, I was actually going to try to get together or bring to Harvard, rather, people who matter on this, who have important things to say. And I'm just going to go one-on-one with them. And I'm going to try as much as possible to play devil's advocate, to really stress test their ideas, and then open it up to our students to ask questions. And I really wasn't thinking that this would be a controversial enterprise or that I would have to deal with protest or opprobrium, because I also had a thesis, which was that our students and our community is just hungry for this. They want the difficult conversation. And I thought, let me push the envelope a little bit with this conversation. And instead of selecting just very sagacious people who I know will be wise people who I know will not throw any bombs or create any fireworks, let me get some people who I know will disagree with each other fairly intensely and see what happens. And so this panel, I had the dean of Princeton's School of Public and International Affairs, co-author and friend of mine, Emeni Jamel, and I had David Makovsky of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. So Emeni, Palestinian-American, David Makovsky, well-known scholar and interpreter of Israeli politics and, you know, leans, you know, quote-unquote pro-Israeli, whatever that means. And they really did disagree. They disagreed intensely. They were gesticulating wildly, but they were always civil and friendly. Gesticulating, I've been noted, told, is also a verboten word. Okay. They were using their hands. That's how excited they were. And after that event, people, you know, typically line up to talk to the speakers, and a few people also wanted to talk to me. And some were clearly Israeli by their accent. Some were clearly Arab by their accents. And all of them were saying to me, I've been going to all your events. This is the best one, because the disagreement had been had. And so I thought, okay, in the spring, I'm really going to lean into that. And I'm going to do these one-on-one conversations. And I'm going to be the disagreeable party. I'll be disagreeable, but friendly. But I'm going to try to corner people and try to, as I said, test the strength of the different arguments. There were a couple of other little episodes that made me do this, and I don't want to drop names or anything, but like Bill Ackman had come to campus to host a screening of video that the Israeli Defense Forces had compiled of the body cam footage of the Hamas terrorists, of what they perpetrated on October 7th.
Did he bring a video of the body count of the Palestinian civilians in Gaza?
No, of course not.
He did not, right?
No, he did not do that. But, you know, there's ways in which I think he is quite interesting and even maybe a little bit miscast publicly. But I mean, I've never talked to him, except I was at this event and somebody, after they showed the video, he did a kind of fireside chat, and somebody asked him, you know, about his view of how Harvard was handling post October 7th. And he said, you know, I'm really disappointed because Harvard has not been convening the academic discussions of this. Right. Where are the panels? Where are the, you know, and I thought to myself, what am I, chop liver? That's literally what I've been doing. And then there was also a student of ours at the Kennedy School who wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe. And that op-ed basically was an indictment of Harvard. It said, Harvard is not teaching me. I'm a student at the Kennedy School of Government, and Harvard is not teaching me anything about the occupation, about October 7th, et cetera. And again, I thought to myself, like, are you kidding me? I just felt that I was clearly not having the impact that I wanted to have. I was clearly not, I thought I was putting together this really valuable educational opportunity, but people are saying this is not landing, this is not registering. And frankly, the student's op-ed was more alarming to me than Bill Ackman's statement. Bill Ackman isn't on campus, but the student is on campus. The student is on my campus. And for her to be saying that there are just not educational opportunities means that there's something about what I was doing that was just not hitting the mark. And so that's part of why I decided to do these Middle East dialogues. And I thought, you know, I'm going to really push the envelope in terms of whom I bring. Now, I thought that...
So the question of platforming, who to platform is the...
Yeah.
That's the verb of the hour.
Yeah, who to speak with. I mean, again, I hate the term platforming.
Right.
As I tell my students who do sometimes get upset because I might assign a particular author or, for example, bring a particular speaker that they don't find laudable, and they'll say, why are you platforming this person? I say, I'm not platforming this person. I'm platforming you. I'm giving you an opportunity to ask them a question, to demonstrate to the world why you think this person's view is impoverished or wrong. But when I put together this series, the only speaker who I thought was going to be really controversial was Jared Kushner, who is President Trump's, you know, senior advisor, architect of the set of peace deals between Israel and some Arab countries known as the Abraham Accords. I knew that was going to be controversial. I thought that was going to be the hard one. But the other ones I thought were going to be much less controversial. And, you know, that's not quite how it worked out. I mean, there was plenty of controversy around the Jared Kushner event, but the most controversy was around a Palestinian professor who I invited.
That was Dalal.
Dalal Arafat. And Dalal, I had actually met through a Harvard activity. She was actually at Harvard to do an executive education. That's kind of why it made sense for her to be in the series when she was, because she was already in town. She's a World Bank Young Global Leader. I mean, this is somebody who is who's fairly well known, and her father was one of the a gentleman named Saeb Arafat, who was a major peace negotiator between Israel and the Palestinians. And, you know, she writes for Haaretz from time to time. I mean, this is somebody who is a very strong Palestinian nationalist, but also somebody who engages with Israelis, which is not always the case. So I did not think that that was going to be as controversial as it turned out to be, but people dug up some tweets that she had posted on October 7th and shortly thereafter. And the characteristics of those tweets were, number one, saying something quite similar to what Ray said earlier, which is that, you know, you can't start with October 7th, you have to start with the occupation. I think what particularly triggered people is she had a tweet saying, look, the people of Gaza have been under siege for, 17 years. I'm shocked that you're shocked that they would act out in this manner. Now, my own view is that that was a stunningly unempathetic statement to make when some of the most horrific atrocities any of us have ever seen were in the midst of being perpetrated.
I'm going to borrow some words from Jared's session, the right wrong words. Did you think it was wrong? Did you think what she said was wrong?
Did I think what she said was wrong? There's an empirical
right for the moment and ways to say things. We can all agree that maybe the way she said it, not maybe, the way she said it was unempathetic. Yes. Was it factually correct?
It just obscured the complexity of the situation. Right. And I think
disagree with you. I think they wanted one simple narrative and she offered another simple narrative.
Possibly. But, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates has recently dipped his toes into these waters with a very influential essay that he published on Israel-Palestine. And one of the powerful things that he keeps saying, he's like, everybody tells me that this is complicated. But, you know, I went there and it isn't complicated. And my view is like, sorry, Ta-Nehisi Coates, like, you are a much more consequential person in the world than I will ever be. But you're absolutely wrong on this. Like, no, this is complicated. This is complicated.
That's right.
And you're right that some people may have wanted a different simple narrative. But I'm not sure that that's how I would characterize, for example, our students who on October 7th were reeling because of what they were seeing happening in Israel-Palestine. I think what they were looking for was a kind of human moment of empathy, right? Right. So if somebody had started by saying, what is happening right now in Israel is a great crime against innocent people, and it cannot be justified by any religion or any just cause, no matter how valid it is. However, it is important for us to understand that there's a prehistory to this. It didn't emerge from a vacuum. And if we want to make sure that things like this never happen again, then we're going to have to grapple with some very difficult facts. And I can get into those difficult facts. I've talked about this.
So Ezra and I have very different impressions of that dialogue.
The one with Dalal Arafat.
I can't say names. I can't remember names.
Yeah. Okay.
I found her to be incredibly coherent and logically consistent. And I felt a little heat in the room against her that, you know, the deference shown, you know, Jared compared to the deference shown her was just amazing to me, because I think they're wrong. I think this is a real scholar who wanted to talk about a broader issue. And the heat and the last comment from the gentleman, I'm going to call him a gentleman, that we don't like you, is actually the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Ray and I did have different reactions to that one. And also, like, two of us both watched your interviews with Dalal Arafat and with Jared Kushner. And we had different actions. I find the fact that we reacted differently to be interesting.
Yeah.
Partly at a higher level of like speaking to the question of what is it that you're trying to do? And then I think the fact that Ray and I had had a disagreement relates to why what you're trying to do is, I think, cool and compelling and worth trying, but also like any kind of attempt to try to convene dialogue and kind of convene a learning community, a diverse one, in a challenging environment is very hard to do for any of us, right? So can I try? So I'm going to try to lay out what I think you're up to. Like there's a bunch of questions that came out of it, which is, I think partly, what does Tariq actually think about the answers that your guests were giving to the questions? Sort of in some sense, part of the approach is that it's hard to tell. But my guess is that it's easier to tell what you think, right? If you are a member of, so I think, tell me this is correct. I think you have a class or some other kind of offline small community of learners, as you've talked about in your writing also, that's kind of happening in conjunction with these public dialogues. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was teaching a class on Middle East politics at the Kennedy School.
So my guess is that what I saw you doing is you're asking probing questions.
Yeah.
And if they give you an answer that is a little bit questionable, especially when looked down the other side of the of this conflict, you'll probe again and then you'll see. And then if they give you actually a compelling answer, you'll maybe dig a little deeper or something like that and take them to another step. Or you'll essentially leave it hanging. Mm-hmm. And then people who are attuned to the way that you and your learning community think about what makes for a coherent or a compelling approach. And as you say, right, it basically, I think you're looking for a level of complexity, a level of empathy with two sides, a level of realism. Basically, if you're not giving answers along those levels, you're going to probe around at it, but you're not going to actually like say, guess what? That's not such a coherent or compelling answer. But that might come up in your post discussion.
I would have used one word, signifying, to borrow from Henry Louis Gates, the whole concept of the idea of signifying from the Black community, where you're going to comment on their comments with statements that insiders, members of a community, recognize right. quickly and understand that, in fact, you're being critical of what that person just said. But not everyone knows that you were right. critical of what that person right. just said.
And the analogy I use, like when we have doctoral students, prospective doctoral students come in and visit like our research seminars, which for me and Ray, I think Ray, right? This is like the center of what we think of as like our learning communities here and our doctoral programs and just research communities in general. When they come in, usually what happens, it's a visiting speaker and they're presenting their research. And then there's folks in a seminar who are asking questions around that research. You know, often what has happened is that then afterwards, the visiting prospective PhD student comes back to my office and we talk about their interest in the program, whatever it is. And I say, how do you like the seminar? And they'll say invariably like, oh, wow, such interesting research. It was exciting. And I'll say, okay, interesting. How do you think the room liked the talk? Mm-hmm. And then they think, huh, they don't know. And then I'll say, usually, they didn't really like it that much.
Yeah.
And then they're like, really? I'm like, yeah. He said, you notice those questions people were asking? They were testing to see how the scholar actually thinks about their work and presents it. And they didn't really love the answers. They probed around here and there. And then as one of our advisors would say, like we talk to each other through the speaker, right? Now, mm-hmm. unless you're part of that continuous learning community, you don't really know. So that's what I saw you doing too. But one of the downsides is someone who's not clued in doesn't really know what it is that they should take away at some level mm-hmm. if you're playing the Tariq role.
Can I double down on it?
Yeah,
there's another moment to it. We have some postdocs who have joined us recently. And, you know, I'll ask them, hey, I haven't seen you around. And they're like, I was here. I said, I didn't see you in any of the workshops. I didn't see any of the seminars. You're not here. And so our graduate students will often want to come to me or I'll see them outside of the seminar talking to Ezra about the seminar. And I'm like, none of this counts. If you didn't make those comments in the room, it doesn't count. It's cheap talk. That's something else we got from our advisor, Ron Burt. When we took him to task around a particular seminar.
We would never do that.
And Ron said, that's all cheap talk, because if you had something to say, you should have said it in the room. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole focus of our culture, is what's happening in the room. And that's what mm-hmm. we think you're doing in your dialogue. It's creating that type of moment, that type of community.
Yeah.
Well, can I try to respond to that?
Please.
Ezra, I think you have done a better job of articulating a theory behind the Middle East dialogues. You articulated a kind of what sounds like it would be a very reasonable theory for somebody trying to do something like this. However, you know, I also feel that there's, and I'm not sure, you're not trying to mask this at all. I feel like there's an intense criticism here of my enterprise. And I just want to sort of say a few things. The first thing is that—
I'm going to disagree with you. There is not an intense criticism of you and your enterprise and what Ezra said. It's in fact a celebration. We had an hour and a half shouting match over this. It is not a criticism of you.
So look, what I am trying to do is provoke the shouting match.
Okay, good.
What I am trying to do is to, first of all, to make plain to everybody, and this is not something I'm just doing for my students. And so when you raise that point that there, you said something like, I'm putting words in your mouth, you said something like, Tark, it's clear that there is some synthetic work, some analytical work that happens in a closed space after the event, and that's where the payoff of this entire thing is achieved. And so if you're one of just the audience members or the YouTube viewers who is seeing this, you're actually not getting the full value or the full experience that is intended, because there's a whole other set of things that happens behind a closed door.
Yeah, you may even be misled.
Backstage, et cetera.
What we do for most content that we are exposed to is we just basically read into it what we want to read into it, right?
Right, right. And I guess part of what I'm hoping that the style of these events makes possible or makes harder is you just reading in what you want to read in. Because if I'm doing my job well, and if the audience members are doing their job well, we're asking the follow-up question that bursts the bubble or lays bare the contradiction or the incoherence, et cetera. So the goal, absolutely, Ray and Ezra, was for each of these events to be a self-contained experience and for the viewer to be able to derive value of this without afterwards having to have a conversation with Tarek Masood. Now, obviously, I fail in a million ways in every single one of these encounters. Ray said that he was shocked by the deference accorded to Jared Kushner and the lack of deference accorded to Dalal Arakat. And the way Ray framed it, because he's a nice guy, is he was talking about the audience. But I know that Ray's really talking about me. That, you know, when Jared Kushner was speaking, I was actually quite polite. And by the way, I was also polite with Dalal, but I had less difficulty sort of pushing back on Dalal or, you know, asking follow-up questions, et cetera. And what people don't realize is that there is also a learning process that happens through these interviews. Jared Kushner was the first one I did. And here's the other thing. For me to convince Jared Kushner to come to Harvard, I had to do a lot to indicate to him that it would be an orderly event, there would be no disruption, et cetera. And in the middle of the event, very close to the beginning, people don't know this because it's not on the video, a group of students stood up in the back of the room holding up banners calling Jared a genocidal maniac and a nepotistic, you know, nepo baby, I think was the term. And they just stood in the back of the room holding these banners very quietly. Huh. And I catch them out of my eye. Jared even mentioned it. He said, here we go.
He caught them out of his eye as well. I was wondering what he was looking at.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see the pickup.
Yeah,
on
he
that.
Said, you hear at some point, he says, here we go.
Exactly.
Here we go. And for the next 10 minutes, I don't know what Jared Kushner said. The entirety of my mental energy and limited cognitive capacity was focused on these folks. What are they going to do? And how am I going to manage it? And I have to say, to the credit of these students, they stood there quietly with their banner for 10 minutes, and then they left.
Very good.
And it was so orderly, and I'm grateful to each and every one of them for demonstrating what an orderly protest looks like. It was so orderly that one of the folks in the audience came up to me afterwards and said, oh, you must have arranged that, Tariq. That was the Tariq Masood Brigade, wasn't it? I said, what kind of, like, how intelligent you guys? Can I just say,
one of the lessons from our time is that there is no kind of thing, like, especially something that looks bad for you or some or a challenge for you, that people can't then guess it's a conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I was so concerned about disruption, et cetera, during that event, that I think I may have been maybe less freewheeling than I usually am. So, like, for example, there's a part where Jared Kushner talks about the 1967 war. And he says, you know,
Israel didn't quite get it right. It was, he didn't know if it was 67, 73.
Well, that too.
But I think, confession.
I think I could have done a better job. And, you know, I will say, you know, in the lead up to that event, when we announced it, I mean, so many of my colleagues were upset with me. And, you know, I got emails being like, what are you thinking? Like, why do you think that this guy has anything to say? And I'm like, look, Abraham Accords, pretty big deal in my world. He just came out with a book in which he said a lot of interesting things that I want to ask him about. And he, who knows, Trump could win. So he might be back in office. And I do teach at a Graduate Institute of Public Affairs. These are the kinds of people you need to hear from. Sorry. And my intention was to really try to push him. But you saw, like, for example, so when he said something about 1967, he said, you know, Israel had to defend itself. And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, you know, it was a preemptive attack. And so ordinarily, I think my ordinary style, I would have been like, oh, hold up. That was preemptive, man. But instead, because I was so meek, right? I was just like, preemptive. It was preemptive. And some people appropriately got upset with me. And they said, Masood, like, we know you. That's not your MO. Your MO is to come on like a ton of bricks. Why were you so meek? And my, you know, view is, A, it was the first one. The room was packed. There'd been this protest. I'm trying to keep things positive. And look, I think I could have done a lot better in a lot of different ways, but I also think this was an opportunity, one of the few opportunities that we've had here at Harvard to really interrogate anybody from the Trump administration about anything that they did. So in the end, I don't regret it, even though I wish I had pushed back more on certain things. Like, I'll give another example. After the interview, about a month after the interview, a clip of it started going viral. And my analysis of why the clip started going viral is that, because it was so far after the event, was that there was a lot of criticism at that particular moment, which we're talking like now March of 2024, a lot of criticism of the Biden administration on its handling of the war in Gaza. And then Jared had said certain things that could be interpreted as like way worse. So if you're a Biden supporter, you could say, you're unhappy with President Biden, look at what the Trump people want to do. And basically they put out this clip or clipped it together such that it made it look like Jared Kushner was saying, Gaza is great waterfront property and we should move all the Palestinians out of Gaza into the Negev desert and then develop the great waterfront property.
Which they didn't have to trim it that much to make that statement, by the way.
But it was a distortion, right?
I know.
Because
it was a distortion.
The waterfront property part, he was talking about how Hamas had squandered the opportunity of governing Gaza, that Gaza could be great if people would focus on building up livelihoods. I think that's literally what he said.
It is.
But then later, when I asked him in a different section, you know, he had this proposal. I said to him, look, you know, he said, the Egyptians should take the Gazans while Netanyahu is clearing out Hamas. I said to him, the Egyptians don't want to do that because everybody is afraid that when the Gazans leave Gaza, Netanyahu will never let them back in. And he said a lot of things there.
He said, Gaza's not really a place.
He said, borders change during war. Like, he said all this stuff. But he also said, my proposal is for them to come into the Negev, you clean it up, and then nobody is saying they shouldn't go back. And because he said that, I made a calculation. Like, okay, he ended on this point. I'm not going to belabor this. I have a lot of other things I want to ask him.
Right.
So let me keep moving. But if I were to do it all over again, I would have said, like, okay, hold on. I understand you are not advocating for Gazans to be relocated from their land. But what are you talking about when you say Gaza isn't a place or borders change during war? Right. Are you open to Israel's borders changing? Like, it was, you know, an opportunity that, you know, I missed. And that also made me much more cognizant about time management, because I felt that, well, look, I'm not perfect. I'm probably the dumbest person in most rooms I enter at Harvard. And so what I need to do is make sure that I leave enough time for the audience to get in and ask their questions. Because if I drop something, somebody else will pick it up.
We closed off our last episode where Lily told us about this new course that she and her colleagues in MIT's School of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences have developed for undergraduates, called Compass, which is organized around three questions, right? And they are, what do we value? How do we know what we know? And what do we owe each other? Right. And it seems like doing this deep dive into, you know, the way that you're kind of constructing the dialogues, Tariq, why you did it, how you do it, how you're managing it, noticing things that you want to improve as you go through it, that they certainly apply a set of answers to those questions. Clearly, I think what we value, there's some things here that you have pretty strong views about in terms of what it is that we, universities, you know, HKS, what we value, and that at the heart of it is sort of this, I'm going to use a three-letter word for epistemological, right? How we know what we know, right? And what do we owe each other, right? Do you have thoughts about those questions, Tariq?
You know, those are great, important questions. And when you sent them, I had a feeling of dread because I realized that I hadn't thought about, you know, I'm not, maybe this is not something I should confess, but I really did not go into this enterprise with a full set of answers to these very important questions. So even now, for example—
We're lucky we don't have to answer them either.
Yeah, I think the people who wait to have fully thought out answers to these kinds of questions never do anything. You did the opposite. Yeah. You said something needs to be done. Right. Let's do it.
Yeah. Right. What do we value? I mean, I believe that one of the characteristics of a place like MIT or Harvard is value pluralism. We're not going to agree on what we value, except at like some very, very, very high level. How do we know what we know? I mean, I certainly don't know the answer to that. I know it's a question that I always ask. Like whenever I go into the field or I tell my students, I say, anytime somebody makes a factual claim to you, I want your follow-up question to be, how do you know that? People say like, oh, in my village, people don't vote on the basis of ideology. They vote on the basis of, how do you know? Okay. And I think some of that came through in some of these interviews. And then the last question, what do we owe each other? To the extent that I have a good answer to any of these, I think it's that. And my answer to it is, well, what we owe each other is number one, the benefit of the doubt. So if somebody does or says something you don't like, you owe it to them not to go out with the pitchfork or condemn them or attribute bad motives. I think it's important. And I'm so glad that Lily is teaching that course and posing these questions for us to think about in all of our work, because certainly I know that it'll make me a little bit more thoughtful when doing these things. So let me just try to give some unlettered answers to these questions. So what do I value? I really value disagreement. And, you know, if you were to ask me, where does that come from? I think part of it is just my psychology. I'm sure I score high on trait disagreeability or whatever that is called in the social psych. There's a metaphor, I can't remember who used it, but they said something like, you know, whenever I see people agreeing on something, I want to run to the other side of the room. And I just felt that very deeply as a description of my psychology. And the reason for that is like, I don't want to be a fool. I want to get at the heart of the matter and the truth of the matter. So why do I value disagreement? I lived in the United States till I was 9 years old. Then we moved to Saudi Arabia. And I went to an Islamic school in Saudi Arabia. And I remember feeling like it was very cramped. And there's a set of answers that you could give to questions that were correct. And then there were things you could say that were clearly incorrect and therefore you should not say them. And I remember having two thoughts. The first thought I had was like, wow, school is much easier here than in America because like I know the script. I know what to say. You know, we would have classes on Islamic studies and you would be given like an exam question. Please describe the characteristics of Umar ibn al-Khattab, who is the second caliph, ruler of the Muslim community after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And like, you wouldn't even need to study for that because you could just list good qualities. He was a pious man who feared God and who upheld virtue. So in a way, that was very easy. Okay. But another way, it was just stultifying. I remember once in class being told that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and I'm a Muslim, I'm practicing Muslim, but he said the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, split the moon in half as a miracle. And I remember thinking to myself, like, well, clearly that's not true. Like, we have NASA, they went to the moon. Nobody said like, hey, we found a fault line where the moon had been split in half. So I'm like, this is clearly metaphorical. And I wanted to say that to the teacher. And I thought to myself, I'm not going there. Because if I say, hey, wait, you mean, sir, you mean it's metaphorical, right? That's a metaphor. The next thing is people are going to jump on me like, oh, taught it. You don't believe in the miracle. Are you a kafir? Are you a non-believer? I was like, I don't want that. And so when I came back to the States and I went to a high school where every class was conducted around a table and it was all about debate. And I'm not in the classroom to learn what the professor thinks and to echo it back to her. I'm in the classroom to figure out what I think and to try to argue for why that's a reasonable position. That for me was like opening a window in a dark room, and it's where I want to live. And I have felt in recent years in the academy, it feels much more like the Saudi Arabia of my childhood, where there's a lot of things we can't talk about, a lot of arguments we can't have, a lot of views with which we are not supposed to engage, e.g. Jared Kushner. And so I've always, for me, part of what I'm trying to do is kind of push against that. And, you know, again, I'm not as smart as you gentlemen or as Lily. If I were, I'd be teaching at MIT. But, you know, Lily is talking about a course that she's trying to offer in order to inculcate these, I think, quite salutary habits, quite beneficial. I tried to do something similar. I proposed a course with a colleague of mine, and it was just like not even approved because people thought that it was not going to be the most useful way of cultivating some of these habits. And the class I had designed with a colleague of mine who's now at UNC was called Hard Questions, Searching for Veritas Across Deep Divides. And what we're going to do is every couple of weeks, we'll take on another hot button issue and we will bring to campus the most articulate, thoughtful exponents on either side of these issues. And we'll do a kind of Middle East dialogues thing, conversation with each of these people.
I'm so sorry, you proposed this having this experience to generalize it.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that you're gonna come help us teach that class at MIT. Is what?
Let's
he's
do
thinking.
It together. Yeah,
that's actually what I'm thinking, and with the title is going to be "Splitting the Moon."
I like that, and putting it back together, maybe.
Putting the moon back together.
Interesting.
So I want to stick with the theme of building that foundation. You clearly have thought about the preparations that the students would need to participate in these kinds of conversations. So you told the Boston Globe that those values are some of the foundation. You know, you thought an important foundation was psychological safety, but you had to worry they were just taking it too far.
Yep, that's right. I mean, if I were to be even more plain spoken about it, I may have said, like, I think psychological safety is important, but we're taking it too far. You know, I would be happy if we never talked about psychological safety.
Can I give you another version of it?
Yeah.
And Amy talks about this. It's participatory safety.
So yeah.
Amy Edmondson, you know, she references Ed Schein's work on participatory safety. And Ed's concept of participatory safety, and it's more than three syllables, is in that context, we have to judge people, but the trick is to judge people and their ideas slowly, such that it's okay to make a mistake. Now, we're going to judge you, right? Because there is a right and wrong. But if we judge too quickly, people will be reluctant, right? But if we never judge, What kind of progress are we going to make? And so the trick is finding that balance between.
That's good.
He described it as two concerns. One of them is the risk of failing. If the risk of failing is so high, they won't learn.
Yeah.
But you have to counterbalance that with the risk of being selected out. And so you have to turn up the risk of being selected out to overcome the risk associated with failing. So they say, listen, I'll take a chance because I don't want to be excluded. I'm going to get in here and I'm going to try to learn and do better. That's that shine.
Yeah. I think if we're talking about a classroom and, you know, these students are, you know, we're in a semester long or year long enterprise together, it's incumbent upon me to create an atmosphere where people feel safe enough to venture their views, to argue with me, argue with each other. And so in that context, I believe a conversation about safety is valid and important, and we should think about it before we design our class. I've experienced pleas to or appeals to safety in other contexts, though, where I think they are less appropriate. And so, for example, we do public things at a place like Harvard, okay? If I were to bring Benjamin Netanyahu to give a public address at the Harvard Kennedy School, followed by some questions by Tariq Masood, somebody will say, Tariq, you are doing harm. I am feeling unsafe as a result of this. I feel that you are, by having these words here, you are doing violence, or you're creating space for violence. And look, I could be totally wrong, and I'm hoping to come out of this knowing that I'm wrong, or learning if I am wrong. But my inclination is to say there is no space for that view. Like when you come and tell me, don't bring Dilal Arakat, that causes harm to me because she doesn't accept my understanding of October. Sorry. Like, I have no time for your objection, just like I have no time for the objection of somebody who says you can't have Jared Kushner here. Another speaker that I brought that caused a lot of controversy was an Israeli parliamentarian named Einat Wilf, who I think is actually quite interesting and intelligent, but she's very tough on Palestinians. And she says Palestinians need to just give up on this fictional idea that they'll ever be able to return to their. Now, I find that hard to listen to. But important. That's an important perspective. Let's engage her.
Pragmatically, right?
Yeah. So I guess just to come back to the point is that I think there are some fora or some arenas in the university where we should pay precisely zero attention to safety.
So can I push on that? Precisely zero?
Precisely zero.
Let's say, I mean, the classic example.
I'm about to change my mind.
You're not, because you're going to be two against one on this one. What do you mean by zero is what he's asking you. Do you mean zero,
right,
or zero?
Right. So like a classic example, and not in the topic space that you're talking about, would be, you know, someone who's denying basic, say, scientific facts, someone who's denying basic historical facts, especially
the
ones that are highly
interesting. The metric there isn't safety. The metric there is validity. Like that's an appropriate metric. But if somebody is going to show up and say something that has not been adjudicated scientifically to be false, but nonetheless causes a lot of angst for some segment of students, well, if it's a view that is on an important issue that with which we as professionals think one should engage, then we should just engage it. And when somebody shows up and says, you know, I'll give you an example from my corner of the world. Like my entire intellectual enterprise has been to argue against the idea that there's anything inherent in Islam or in Arab culture that renders us inimical to or inhospitable to democracy. Because it's a fact of the world that the Arab world is the one spot on the globe that doesn't have a single solitary liberal democracy. And lots of people spend a lot of energy trying to figure out why this is. And one of the sets of arguments that I've always hated is like, oh, it's your religion or it's your culture. And I've had plenty of students who object to engaging those kinds of arguments. But my view is they're important arguments made by smart people. And the only way to eradicate these arguments is to engage them and show them to be wrong. And by the way, nobody's done that yet. Nobody's definitively shown them to be right, but nobody's definitively shown them to be wrong. And here's another thing. We may never be able to do it. You know, we were never able to resolve this because that's the nature of the kind of inquiry with which we're involved. In fact, you know, this course that I was going to offer at Harvard.
And that you're going to co-teach at MIT?
Well, that would be an honor. But, you know, it had one thing that my co-instructor and I decided to do was to dedicate the first part of class to modeling for students how you should engage with arguments that you dislike. And so my co-instructor is a scholar of religion, so he wanted to engage in arguments that basically denigrate religion or, you know, consider religion to be equated with backwardness. And I wanted to engage with arguments that attribute the lack of democracy in the Arab world to religion and culture. And I labeled my session, "Are the Arabs incapable of getting and keeping democracy?" And then I have a little section description that makes very clear that I hate that argument, and I'm going to show you how I engage with it and what questions I feel are resolved and what questions I'm still banging my head against, etc. And we presented this to the committee that approved such classes, and one of the esteemed scholars said, you know, there's many quite tendentious things here and offensive things. And I was like, well, we tried very hard not to have anything that could be characterized as such. Could you give me an example? And that was the example. Are the Arabs incapable of getting
the posing of the question?
Yeah, posing of the question. And I'm like, I'm sorry. This is a question that is of utmost importance. You scratch beneath the surface in any policy conversation in Washington, D.C. Doesn't matter if you're talking to a Democrat or a Republican. This argument rears its head. Like, you know, and so
can I say, if I understand it, one of the reasons, I mean, you've done a lot of work and we'll post links to about the Arab Spring and the hopes of a democracy that, you know, from various Arab states over the last 15 years, right?
Yeah.
It also is a live issue for, I think, everyone who's got a stake in the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, right? Where the question of what kind of institutions. Now, there's questions about Israeli democracy, big time.
Yeah, big time.
And then there's questions about people who have to live with the consequences of those decisions. That question you're posing is a very big question.
Yeah.
Especially since people look around, they see essentially failed states, either authoritarian states or failed states in that environment, right?
Right. 100%, right? So, like, if we were to talk about Israel-Palestine for a minute, let's talk about something like October 7th. So one group of people will say that October 7th is the expression of a deep-seated Islamic or Arab refusal to accept Jews as equal and as sovereign in any part of the Holy Land. And another group of people, among whom I will count myself, say, no, October 7th has to be understood as part of a much longer struggle between Arabs and Jews over a set of goods, some of which are divisible, some of which are indivisible. But this is what people do when they fight about stuff. And we don't have to, it doesn't have anything to do with some dysfunctions in either Islam or Judaism or whatever. Okay.
As you're saying, right? It's about indivisible, especially land, right? That's we can't physically divide it up.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing is, like, the land is divisible. I mean, you may not like how it's divided.
Yeah.
But what isn't divisible is, like, who gets authority over the Temple Mount.
You physically look at, like, say, Temple Mount. Yeah. You can't actually contain the use of the space in a way that's separable.
Right.
Because of the way that space is constructed. It's a great metaphor for the entire thing.
But my view, frankly, is that there are very intense disagreements about the nature of what it is we're observing. And I can imagine this has happened, right? That if I bring somebody to campus who says to me, look, I'm going to try to explain to you why this really is a religious conflict, okay? I'm going to quote for you chapter and verse, and I'm going to lay out the history of this for you so that you can understand that the minute Jews started showing up in the Holy Land, Muslims and Arabs were committing grave acts of terrorism against them. You know, my decision to invite somebody like that to campus to hear what they have to say and push on it would be opposed by a lot of people who would say I'm platforming something harmful. And my view is no. This is an important view that lots of people hold. I don't happen to hold it. Let's probe it. And if you want Harvard or MIT or the University of North Carolina to be a place where we can't engage that argument and hear what that person has to say and argue with them, then you want Harvard and MIT and the University of North Carolina to be places where we are not producing knowledge on these questions. And I'm completely unsympathetic with that. So when somebody tells me, hey, there's a set of views here that I don't want to hear from, and if you platform them, you are platforming harm and violence, and I've concluded, like, no, actually, I want to hear that view. I think that's a problem. That doesn't mean that we should throw the door open to every extremist, but the metric should be not, I dislike this view. The metric should be, you know, how rigorous is it? How justified would a reasonable person be in thinking that there was something here?
So when I go into a situation, I find myself, if I feel unsafe, I ask myself, why am I feeling this way? Ed Schein talks about this. It's like the purpose of dialogue is not really to learn something about the other side. The purpose of dialogue is to learn something about yourself. And in fact, how my assumptions, how my cultural beliefs, why my understandings.
How I know what I know.
How I know what I know.
What do I value?
What do I value? How those, in fact, are the things that are leading to my reaction. So the first step is learning more about myself. And that's the whole purpose of this kind of dialogue, is understanding Ray more. And advisor moment again, Ron Burt used to say to me, get over yourself so you can get on to other people. That's what we're trying to do with our students, is help them understand themselves so then they can start to learn more about other people.
You know, I think you had said in a couple of different ways that, well, what's the edge? Who would I not platform? And, you know, I was saying, people who are saying things that have been demonstrated to be false or something like that, right? That there's scientific consensus around. And you were saying a reasonable person a second ago, right?
Yeah. You're the second speaker. I'm not here to teach you anything. I'm here to encourage you to think for yourself.
Yeah,
that's what she said to your audience.
Yeah, that Dalal did say that. But, you know, I just want to say a couple of things. So the first is a question to Ray. You know, Ray, you said you've asked yourself in settings where you feel unsafe, like, why do I feel unsafe? And I'm going to suggest that you actually have never felt unsafe. Like, what does unsafe mean? What does it mean?
Okay. Not the unsafe that people in academic settings are thinking about.
Right.
I've never felt that way.
Yeah. No. So I want to go further and say, this is, you know, my penchant for maybe exaggeration, and then I'll come to a more reasonable position. But I want to start by saying, in our classrooms where we are discussing ideas, nobody in any classroom has ever felt unsafe. Like, you may have felt that your lack of preparedness is about to be exposed, or you may have felt not very smart. If somebody says to me, hey, you made me read Samuel Huntington and that made me feel unsafe, I want to respond by saying, I don't think you're using that term correctly. Because
you replace feeling unsafe with feeling challenged is what I'm saying.
Yes. Because if we say I'm feeling challenged,
yes,
giddy up. That's what this is for.
Right.
You know, you're supposed to feel challenged. Thank you. And that's why people use the language of safety in order to foreclose certain lines of inquiry or certain lines of discussion. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing you're pushing me on, like, what are the boundaries? Okay. Who would you bring? And my response to that is, as you just said, look, I have a certain small degree of knowledge about a particular area. I have judgments. I'm going to make those judgments and I'm going to bear responsibility for them. Okay.
You're
so
curious.
Tariq Masood is going to bring Dylan Raqqat or Jared Kushner and people are going to attack him. That's perfectly fine. You should attack me. Go ahead. I'm not saying you can't attack me. But what I want the university to do is to say, hey, this guy, he's a faculty member with academic freedom, and we are utterly silent on what our faculty do. And if we are a healthy institution, then we're going to have Tariq Masood doing his thing, and we're going to have Ray Reagan's doing his thing, which may be a little bit different. And collectively, we're all going to be doing a lot of stuff that certainly in some areas is complementary, in some areas we're competing with each other, contesting each other. But as a whole, it will, I think, advance the enterprise of a university. So that's sort of where I come from. When people would say to me, like, what do you want Harvard to do for you? I say, look, Harvard did what I wanted to do. It gave me tenure. Okay, that's the protection. Like, I didn't lose my job because I brought Dylan Erkat or Jared Kushner, right? Even though there are some people who are saying Tariq Masood is a Trumpy, and other people who are saying Tariq Masood is an anti-Semite because he invited Dylan Erkat. And other people say Tariq Masood is an unreconstructed Zionist because he brought Einat Wilf. The university made it possible for me to bring these people and not get fired. But I want the university to take the next step, which is to be silent about these things and to laud the fact that these conversations are happening, to create space for more of the conversations to happen, and to stop there.
There's a strong gym metaphor in the material that you sent us in terms of building people up, getting ready for competition, challenge. And so what do you think we can do to prepare people to face the challenge?
Yeah. By the way, can I just say something about that gym metaphor? I was so proud of myself for that metaphor. I thought it was the most brilliant thing.
I liked it.
And then I mentioned it to somebody, and they're like, oh, yeah, Van Jones said that. I was like, what? Van Jones, the CNN guy? And I look, and sure enough, like at the University of Chicago, something like 15 years ago, he's there and he's saying, like, this is the gym. I'm like, Van Jones, how dare you? So I now have to attribute that to Van Jones, although I promise I never heard him say that.
That's okay.
So, you know, I guess, so let me just first restate the question to make sure I'm asking it. You said, Tariq, you've talked a lot about this idea of the university as a gym, that we need to build up our muscles in order to engage with this very difficult world that lies before us. And so how do we do that? And I guess my answer is, like, that's what I thought the Middle East Dialogues was. Like, you just got to do it. And one of the things that I think makes me sit uneasily with some of the other efforts that are going on around our campus and other campuses in order to encourage constructive conversation is I think people spend too much time talking about it and not enough time doing it.
Okay.
And in fact, I think some of the talking about it is counterproductive because it pathologizes it. These kids are smart. They have higher SAT scores than any of us did. Like, let's just make it clear that it is expected that you will show up and you will be respectful and smart.
It's a thing. Okay. Small classrooms. You actually do have some ideas around the gymnasium that you would want to build to build people up for these kinds of discussions, right?
Well, I mean, that's a whole other set of issues about how we determine how big classes should be. But, you know, I generally, I mean, this may be sort of my disagreeableness, but one of the other walls against which I've banged my head for a number of years is just the whole teaching and learning industrial complex that we have at the modern university, where you have these people who have spent a lot of time thinking very carefully about how to create optimal learning environments for our students. And one set of ideas that was very prevalent here at the Kennedy School is that we need to move away from the sage on the stage model and towards a model that's closer to coaching, et cetera. And I think there's a really good insight there, but it's not taken seriously because when we at the Kennedy School built our new building, we built it with these massive classrooms that fit like 100 people in them. And in these classrooms, I mean, it's modeled after business school classrooms. There are like little tables to which people can go into breakout groups and things like that. And I'm like, look, I'm not teaching people math problem sets. Like, what am I going to do a breakout group on? My view is that for those of us who are teaching the kinds of things that I teach, where, you know, we're not doing problem sets. We need to talk about difficult arguments. We need to dive into readings, et cetera. That the way to create an optimal learning environment there is to reduce the class size so that everybody has enough time to participate. And the stakes of participation are reasonable. Like if you're in a Tariq Masood's class with 100 people and Tariq Masood asks you a question about, you know, the role of culture in explaining low women's labor force participation in the Arab world, that's a high stakes question that you've been asked.
And you got 30 seconds to answer it.
You got 30 seconds, and you got to answer it in front of all these people who you know a little bit and to whose parties you want to be invited.
And you may not be able to speak again for a couple of classes. And that's going to really say to everybody who you are.
Exactly. And so if we move to a more seminar style model where we can give our students attention, et cetera, and yet we don't do that. We're not doing that. I do think moving us towards smaller classes where we can develop more deep and robust relationships with our students and make them feel like they're part of a conversation as opposed to a caller on a radio call-in show. I think that's really important. But at the same time, like at universities, we do public events. So certainly what I don't want to be saying that the only kinds of conversations we can have to be in these small, closed communities where we can. No, I mean, we should have those, but we should also have the big fora where the audience is not just the university students, it's its faculty, its staff, and it's the broader community. And we should be able to engage in those fora like strong, self-confident adults.
So there's two ways of taking what you said. One of them is what the university could do, but it's also something that we could do. You're also suggesting that we could teach more.
Oh, yeah. Say more.
Well, if you want smaller classes, right?
Oh, yeah.
The faculty have a responsibility. If you're going to make them smaller, right? The university could help, but faculty also have an obligation to teach more.
Oh, without a question.
Great. Don't tell them that.
I'm just saying.
I mean, I absolutely remember there was one time when I was an assistant professor, I had a class with 99 people in it. And I went to the administration. I was like, look, this is not going to work. There's too many people. And so I had to beg the administration to allow me to break up the class into two back-to-back classes with 45 people each, and I got no extra credit for it, or it was a favor that was done for me.
Right.
But the class worked really well, and I was much smarter in the second class. You know.
Can I ask a question? The word that came to mind originally was insurance, right? And then the word assurance jumped into my head for some reason, which actually felt more appropriate given what you've been saying. Is that what a university can do is kind of build up a kind of confidence in people where they feel comfortable having these conversations. I don't like the word neutrality is what I'm trying to say. I don't like the idea that a university is just a neutral place. Like it has to have some positive element that's not simply get out of my way.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a statement, a question. I'm not quite sure what that is, but it's
provocation.
I mean, I know you and I agree on this, that like the word neutrality just doesn't fit our image of what a university should be trying to do.
Well, I think that's right, but policies or those of us who want the university to pursue or abide by policies of neutrality are not saying that's all the university does. Like the university admits students, it hires faculty, it opens and closes departments. Like there's a whole set of decisions that leaders of universities, and here I'm going to include faculty, get to make about what the university is. But then when we come to the politics of the day, that is where I want the university in its public pronouncements to be neutral.
Understood.
Like I want Ray Reagan's to speak. I don't want Ray Reagan's to be neutral or Ezra Zuckerman Sivan to be neutral or Tariq Masood to be neutral, but the university should trust that we picked these students and we picked these faculty and we have the right mix of students and faculty who are doing good stuff. And when one group of students, for example, comes out and says that October 7th and the crimes of October 7th are entirely attributable to the State of Israel, which in my view is a wrong view, the university should have said nothing about it. You know, there were some alumni of the university and friends of the university who were very upset with the students who said that, and appropriately so. But it is not the place of the university as the university to comment on it. It's the place of Tariq Masood it's the place of Ezra and of Ray. We can say, like, I think these students are wrong, but the university shouldn't say anything about it.
If the university is doing its job, is what I hear you saying. If the university is doing its job and building institutions, selecting the right people, building the right climate, it shouldn't have to say anything at that moment.
Right, because, by the way, there are Israeli and Jewish and other students on campus who would have articulated the exact opposite view of those students. So for me, Harvard or an institution would only be dysfunctional and requiring of some correction if all the students are just saying what those student groups said, the Arab students group said, and there was nobody articulating the alternative perspective. But if
can I use your can I use your gym metaphor real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm short, but I grew up playing basketball, and you know, we won a little bit. Yeah. The coach used to say to us, "I spend all week coaching you. Why should I have to coach you in the games?" In a sense, that's what you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. We should prepare our students, and so we shouldn't have to interfere in these moments.
Right. So let me say one thing. That statement, right, went around the world. It wasn't like when we were growing up and going to college, when you make a statement on campus and it just stays local to that campus. It's like you're speaking into this megaphone that went around the world that people are really interested in what Harvard students were saying. And then you had the president of university who is interpreting it or facilitating the interpretation of that statement as, in some sense, speaking for Harvard unless it's countered by Harvard, right? And so I think it's challenging.
I'm not sure I agree with the second part of that sentence.
Otherwise, why does anyone care? Basically, it seems to somehow be speaking for Harvard. I'm not saying that he's right about that. I'm saying that's the premise of which he's operating, criticizing Harvard for not then criticizing those statements.
And that premise doesn't make any sense. It would do nothing but spend all her time countering statements. Because there's always something being said at Harvard.
Well, I would push back. I would say I agree with you to a point. It's not the craziest thing in the world for people who don't know universities in one way or another to think that when a statement made by dozens of student groups that all have funding from the university that gets out there in public that, in their view, is outside the bounds of propriety in one way or another, that if it's not countered, that it somehow is speaking for the university. Like, we don't think of it that way, I don't think. But it's not the craziest thing in the world. And then you've got the former president of Harvard, who is basically operating on that premise. That presents a big problem. But it's not the craziest premise in the world.
So right now, for example, I can't delete any of my emails because there's a lawsuit against Harvard for being an anti-Semitic place, and I'm one of the people who's mentioned in the lawsuit, so I have to keep all of my emails. And I'm mentioned in the lawsuit because of the interview I did with Dalal Arakat. And the student who's the sort of champion of this, he's somebody I wish you would also talk to because I feel like he is really being misled and misguided by a lot of people. But I think somebody like him is also coming from a place that is understandable, even though I wish somebody would take him by the shoulder and say, you're actually making things worse. But I think where he's coming from is as follows. He looks at other communities on campus that receive a tremendous amount of care from the community. And, when, for example, George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, we all received very heartfelt messages from the administration about the ongoing scourge of racism in our society. And so somebody like him says, okay, we received that when George Floyd was murdered and Michael Brown was murdered, but nothing when it came to October 7th, suddenly the institution rediscovered its capacity for neutrality. And that to him is deeply, again, I don't know him, never spoke to him, and hope not to speak to him because to the extent my life is intersected with his, I'm in lawsuits. But nonetheless, I suspect that if you were to speak to him, that's where the pain comes from. That, my community experienced something that was every bit as searing as what happened to George Floyd or any of the other people who have been subject to grievous violations of their rights by the police. And yet Harvard said nothing about my pain and everything about the pain of others.
And, okay? And can I take two things quickly? One is MIT has also been subject to that criticism.
Yes.
Not, I think, unfairly, though. I don't know if this is true for Harvard. I think MIT had already tiptoed away from that in the spring of 23 when the Dobbs decision came through, and there was a push for some kind of statement about sympathy for the implications of the repeal of Roe v. Wade, and the decision already at that point was, we got to get away from this business, right?
We're not in the business of making statements. We're not in the business of making statements. We are in the business of caring for our community members, though. And so I hate to say it, episode 3 is really talking about that, that the university did learn something, is that while it had built up this infrastructure for supporting underrepresented minorities and different groups, it hadn't built up the same infrastructure for supporting different members of religious communities. And the university is starting to do that. I'm not saying what it's doing is the same, but it at least is trying to be responsive.
So I do think, or Ray and I have talked about this, that you know, we try to do in the first, starting with the first episode, some degree of understanding about why it is that a lot of Jewish members of our community might have felt some failure by the institution, by the university, to support them. And at the heart of what we're trying to develop was the idea that there's the connection that a lot of Jews feel for Israel, and particularly for the event of October 7th, was something that non-Jews, but even some Jews themselves, don't have a clear enough sense of the nature of Jewish peoplehood. And it's understandable that a lot of non-Jews didn't understand the connection, the impact, that there's sort of this logic of collective identity that is harder to see. And so one thing that I picked up on in your dialogues, right, was you were sharing, I think, with Erica Utarek, your sort of enthusiasm for her father. And as I recall, it was Faisal Husseini and Hanan Ashrawi and that team. Basically, there's a team of negotiators from West Bank and Gaza, right, who were the lead negotiators in the late 80s, early 90s. But your enthusiasm for them, and you were describing it through the lens, right, through the sense of your Arab identity and how excited you were for people who could represent a particular Arab nationalist cause, right, that you regarded as just. And so that struck me as something that I think a lot of members of our community don't have a good intuition for. I certainly don't claim to have a strong intuition for, but would be great to hear your sense of, and maybe how that relates also to how members of university campus communities who are Middle Eastern, North African, are impacted by the war in ways that maybe not members of the community don't really fully appreciate.
Okay, that's a big question. So I'm going to try to answer this question, but if I drop pieces of it, we can circle back to them. I want to just start by saying that I am very ambivalent about the language that we sometimes use to describe our community and our responsibility to the members of our community. We talk about care and safety and, you know, you said we have a duty of care to our community. And that one of the lessons of October 7th was that some of the care that we have been showing to members of our different racial communities. And what we learned from October 7th is that there is a set of communities to whose feelings we have been insufficiently attentive. And the answer is now to be attentive to their feelings. I am uneasy with that. In my world, the university would lean into the fiction, admittedly it's a fiction, of us being minds who are brought to this place, shorn of our particularities, and asked to engage in a great and real multi-generational business of truth-seeking. It's something that those of us who get to spend our lives doing must recognize that we're among the most fortunate people on the planet, and that these students, when they get to come and spend 4 years here, thinking and learning and engaging with other minds, that they are partaking of one of the great pleasures and privileges that is available on our planet in this moment in our history. And so my job is to lift you out of your community, to make you not just think of yourself as, I'm an Egyptian. What are my Egyptian feelings about this? And instead get you to engage in this as a thinking human whose bond with the Jewish Ezra Zuckerman Sivan or, you know, the African American Ray Reagans is that we are all together collectively in this enterprise. And I'm going to do everything I can to erase the boundaries between us and help us think together and collectively. And my concern is that when we understand our responsibility to the students as one of making it possible for them to lean into their communities. How can I better accommodate the sensitivities of your particular community that is at odds with this other mission that I've identified?
I agree 1,000%.
So I
want to push back on one thing. Yeah. Tell me. So I think one thing that I was seeing, and you've already agreed, Tarek, that we saw you being a little harder on Dalal Erekat than on Jared Kushner, right? And for all kinds of reasons you mentioned already. But I think one reason is that you identify with her much more strongly. And so I see you being frustrated with her on particularly the issue we mentioned earlier, which is that she won't really distance herself from Hamas, which seems strange given her biography, given everything like that. And you kept on coming back to that, and I've heard you in other dialogues too. But that to me is not a neutral mind who is engaging that question. That's someone who is deeply, deeply committed to development of Arab democracy, right? Democracies in Arab states, and is worried by someone who seems to share that, and you basically promoted her as someone who is basically standing up to authoritarianism within the Palestinian Authority, et cetera. But who doesn't understand why she's like, so that's not only a mind at work, right? That's someone who identifies very strongly and passionately and is like, I feel like I'd be the same way. Like I would probably give Jared Kushner much harder.
He's sneaking in identity, Tarek. He's sneaking in identity.
Because he's closer to me in terms of my identity, right?
Yeah. Let me just push back a little bit. So I think certainly my identity matters in ways that it's worth exploring. But if you were to listen to some of my other interviews, you'd see like when I have an Israeli later on in the series, I push back really hard. So it may be that it is almost certainly the case that I will use whatever resources are at my disposal in a given encounter to create some sense of sympathy and empathy with my interlocutor such that I can get them to listen to me to entertain a cheeky or difficult question. So I'll use whatever tools are at my disposal. And so if that means demonstrating the sharing of culture, I will do that. If that means flattering you as a great negotiator, I will do that. In order to create the conversational...
We didn't notice that at all. No extra flattery. Definitely not.
No, but he's saying what Lily was saying to us at the same time, is that if you want to be an insider in multiple communities, you have to be good at showing empathy.
To create conversational receptivity, I think that's useful. So that may have been some of what you detected with Dalal, but I really would push back against the idea that I felt more frustrated with her than with Jared. On the contrary, frankly, if you were to ask me, with whom do I share more identity? For me, it's a toss-up. Like, Jared and I are both Americans. Like, I'm deeply an American. Like, I can look at you and Ray, and I think these are my countrymen.
Sure.
Okay? So I'm very deeply American.
You said we were your brothers when we first met. Well, now we're just your countrymen?
After the conversation.
Right. I meant it particularly on the cause of essentially promoting democracy in Arab state from that standpoint, as a cause that I think you are not just a mind on, but you are passionately devoted to. That's the sense in which I was talking about.
Yeah. I think that's fair. And I think it's not, you know, obviously it would be stupid for me. This is why I said it was a fiction to say that we must conduct ourselves as if we are these disembodied. That's not possible, but it's an ideal to which we should aspire.
Yes. I think Ray's nodding vigorously. We both agree with that.
It's an ideal towards which we should aspire. And so when I come back to the issue of community and the care that we offer our community, I feel like our responsibility is to give our students the strength to step out of their communities.
So if I'm asking you, hey, Tariq, are there things that universities should have known about, you know, Arab Muslim students, members of the community last year? Just like we've sort of said, there's some things, especially about Jewish peoplehood, it would have been good for members of the community to know. You're kind of saying, you know what? Maybe, but, you know, I'm worried about going too far down that road of like...
Of hardening the boundaries between these communities. I'll give you an example. Harvard University has a Muslim chaplain. In fact, the Muslim chaplain is the only clergyman who is paid by Harvard. I guess that's not exactly true because we have the Plummer Professor of Christian Morals who, you know, is also paid by Harvard, but that's an ancient endowment, you know. But like there's no rabbi who's paid by Harvard, but we do have an imam who's paid by Harvard. And you'll get an email, if you're a Muslim student, you'll get an email in the beginning of the year from the Muslim chaplain's office talking to you about Friday prayer and all of these weekly Islamic discussion sections, etc. And part of me is like, wow, this is the beauty of America. Like at Harvard University, you have this, you know. But then another part of me thinks, well, you know, I don't know how I feel about this. Let's imagine I'm a kind of a Muslim student who's like flirting with heterodoxy. I'm flirting with leaving my religion. And I get to Harvard and the first thing I get is a communication from the university saying, you are a Muslim and here, you, I know you want to pray. Here's prayer for you. And so if you were entertaining the idea like, no, actually, I kind of want to break free. Now Harvard is telling you, no, don't break free. Be in your community. And so a part of me worries about that. Like,
but I don't know, how do they decide who? Well, the other question we would have is, I mean, then you get Harvard into the game of deciding what, like there's a zillion different branches of Islam, right? So, right. I mean, I don't know to say Sunni Shia, right? Right. How are you going to decide
Right? Ezra, you're missing his, in a sense, it's polite, but maybe you are right about his approach. There's a deep criticism of us in the statement that he just made. And in a sense, because we have been engaging in these identity-based discussions. And what he's saying is, yeah, and when you do that, there's the risk of hardening the boundaries between those identities. You might think that you're building cross-cutting ties, but what you're doing is also hardening the distinctions. And I want to try something else. I want to try an approach that softens the distinctions.
Yeah,
that's what I heard you saying.
Yeah, you said that much more eloquently than I would have said it. You know, I feel like, again, just talking from my own life experience, I've always been in diverse communities, okay? I was born in Wisconsin, but I came to awareness in a suburb of Detroit that had two big communities in it, neither of which was mine. Right? Orthodox Jews and Chaldean Iraqi Christians. And there was also, I think, a healthy Black community, but the two communities I remember very clearly were Chaldeans and Orthodox Jews. And feeling like adjacent to both of them, but, you know, not quite. And consequently, feeling very discouraged when people would lean into their communities, feeling left out. Like, for, you know, and then when I moved to Saudi Arabia, I was in another community where in my school, it was, you know, Pakistanis and Indians. And, you know, yes, we all had this superordinate identity of being Muslims, but there were a lot of differences. And I was always cognizant of the fact that I wasn't a Pakistani or an Indian. And so consequently, feeling like I want to be in communion with you, but I can't be your ethnicity. I can't be your religion, but I can be your friend. I can be your fellow student. And so what is that superordinate identity that we can reach towards that allows us to find fellowship in each other and allows you, Ray, to say like, I can be friends with this guy, Tariq Masood. I can be a full friend with him and a brother to him, even though he is not part of the quote unquote community that Harvard decided I'm a member of. And so that's a big part of what I think motivates me. I also think in my own life, you know, I want our students' communities to be sources of strength and not limitation for them. And I have definitely had to work very hard to make sure it's not a source of limitation for me. because I will show up, for example, and I'm the son of immigrants and I'm a Muslim. And so it is assumed that I will hold aloft certain flags. And I don't want to hold aloft any flags. I want to be an earnest searcher of the truth. So, you know, part of the irony of my life was obviously I got attacked from all different corners because of the Middle East dialogues. You know, some people see me inviting Jared Kushner, they get upset. Other people see me inviting Dalal al-Arqad, get upset with me for a totally different set of reasons. And the Arqad one was painful because people just say, oh, Arab Muslim professor at Harvard brings this person who has ostensibly anti-Israel views. He must be an anti-Semite. And, you know, you could see, you know, the Harvard Crimson disabled its comment section. But in the stories about Dalal al-Arqad, there are people on there saying like Tariq Masood and Dalal al-Arqad need to be in a cell in Guantanamo Bay together. Okay. You know, now the irony is that the year before, also in January, I was in hell for a totally different reason, which was Harvard, our dean had denied a fellowship to a human rights activist named Ken Roth, who was very tough on Israel. And so
the head of Human Rights Watch, right?
Yes, Human Rights, Ken Roth. So we got a lot of negative press. And there was a negative story about the Harvard Kennedy School called something like the Harvard Kennedy School's anti-Palestinian bias that was published in Jewish Currents magazine. And the main villain in that story was the dean of the Kennedy School. He was treated unfairly, I think. But a subsidiary villain was yours truly. And why was I listed as a villain? Because the story was that the Kennedy School does not allow Palestinians to have their events. And when it does allow Palestinians to have their events, it insists that this Zionist stooge, Tariq Masood, be the moderator of these events. And the reality is that what would happen is that the Palestinian students would want to do an event. The school would be uneasy about it. And I would tell the school, you have to let them have their event. Get out of their way. Let them do the event. And I would be told, well, would you be, you know, willing to be in the room as an adult supervision just in case? And I'd say, fine, if that's what needs to happen for them to do the event. But then those students would look at this and be like, look at Masood just doing the bidding of these anti-Palestinians. When in fact, the institution is not anti-Palestinian. They're just worried. They just want things to go well. And so the point is that my identity has definitely been an obstacle for me to navigate. And maybe that's why I have a little bit of resentment about it. You know, it's like my Arab students feel that I'm not sufficiently vocal about the cause. And other communities that don't know me might think because I'm an Arab and a Muslim, I am biased against Israelis or Jews or whatever outgroup you want to, which is, you know, again, neither of these is the case. And I think that I am really somebody who's very careful about trying to be neutral, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, identity has been a difficult thing to navigate. And I do wish that people, at least when they engage with me, would just engage with me as a guy who's really being honest when he says, treat me as a disembodied mind. Like, I'm going to give you a fair shake. I'm not going to be biased towards you because I'm an Arab or biased against you because, you know.
I mean, so what I see is a person who's navigated a world that in many instances was the logic of those worlds identity-based. And this person saying, I'm okay with that. I would just like for you to treat me as an individual. And as you were talking, I have to tell you, the image of splitting the moon was coming into my mind. This is a very difficult task. Yeah. Of living in a world where everyone else wants to use a certain logic and you say, right. I'm okay with your logic. Disrespect my logic. That's a little different.
Yeah.
Can I just plug in again? This is the value inequality logic as opposed to value indifference logic, right, Ray, right. From your research?
Yeah.
I mean, Tariq, so it's not a social identity so much, but you are a passionate advocate for and like committed. I mean, you are coming with a scholarly point of view. Yeah. And a commitment to, in particularly around democracy. And that is, I think, if there's a probing around that you're doing, it's around those values and ideals, and that's what you're doing in the university too. And I'll say,
he's the cosmopolitan. He's the cosmopolitan that we're trying to create.
To emulate, I would say. If universities are filled with Tariq Masouds, we would be.
That would be a disaster. We do not want to fill a university with Tariq Masouds.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Tariq, this has been fantastic. Just your openness, you're willing to push back against what we're trying to do, and thereby helping push our agenda forward, which I think is a common agenda, and your recognition of the difficulties and all that for all of us, and why this is so hard. We're really, really grateful for that.
And I just have to say admiration. I won't have much more to say than to say that this has been the last 2-3.5 hours, whatever it is, has just been admiration.
Well, I mean, first of all, the admiration is totally mutual. It's also undeserved.
Too many syllables.
It's totally undeserved on my part. And I just want to say I really very much enjoyed this conversation and learned from it. I think I will be a much more thoughtful person about some of these issues going forward. So thank you for helping me.
Should we roll those credits?
I think we should.
All right. I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
I'm Ray Reagans. And you've been listening to
Outsider
Insider,
a podcast from MIT.
Ezra, can I say it's a podcast brought to you by MIT Sloan? I will.
We're certainly appreciative of MIT Sloan and MIT.
And MIT.
Yep.
And we have some thank yous to do, I believe.
We do.
Yes. Let's thank our executive producer, Kate O'Sullivan.
Yay, Kate.
That's right.
She's awesome.
This has been produced and edited by Lucy McCormick, our star chaser.
That's right, with help from consulting producer Hamid Albadi.
And audio mix by Hansdale Shi.
Thanks, Hansdale.
Thank you.
All right, take care, everyone.
Take care, folks.
So, Ray, that was a fantastic conversation with Tariq. I'm feeling incredibly lucky and privileged we got to meet him, let alone to have that conversation. And, I put a little plug in the end that listeners might find a little bit cryptic, which was referencing your research, Ray. And so I wanted to clarify what that's about. So, I think this is really valuable research that, our listeners should know more about and really speaks to the issues that motivated the podcast in the first place. One of the biggest issues on campus, what we've called an inclusion failure, which we talked about in episode 3. Tariq talks about his experience growing up and why it is that he's come to the view, and then this is where I started to referring to your work, Ray, with Evan Applebaum, Nicole Stevens.
Yeah, I'm glad you said their names. I think of his research with Evan and Nicole. And in particular, this research grew out of, conversations and discussions that Evan and I were having with each other all the time as we were thinking about co-teaching a class or teaching different sections.
And this was in a university setting.
Exactly. And it also illustrates another point, which is, relationships, as you say, they're forged in a university setting. They're a byproduct of we were doing something else. And these relationships emerge. That's the same way I see the relationship that we have with Tariq, is that it's a byproduct of doing this kind of work. On the question of my identity in a situation, I have really two challenges. And the first challenge is, do people like me even belong?
This is taken from the standpoint of a member of the community.
Exactly.
And it has implications for, say, a manager or a professor, someone who's trying to create an environment.
That's right. So how would you create a place, an environment that Ray might find appealing? And it really turns out
appealing and really bring their talents and invest, et cetera. Yeah.
It's kind of related to the issue of the inclusion failures that we were talking about. And it really, the question is, what kind of climate or culture would you want to create? The work out there really contrasted two ways of thinking about this. And one of them was equality, is that the member of a minority group is really concerned with, will people like me be treated fairly and equally? And another approach said, no, the issue is, does the organization realize the distinct value that people like me could create in their setting? Important that we're really having a discussion about how we're talking about group differences. One of them is,
Groups are different. Groups have distinct things to offer. The other one is groups are different, but in this organization, all groups are going to be treated fairly and equally. Mm-hmm. And so then it turns out that which one of these, you know, people are going to find more appealing, where they bring more of their self to the organization, is depends on their level of representation. Am I part of a really small group in an organization? And if I'm part of a really small group in an organization, the question for me is, are people like me welcomed? And so to hear an organization saying that you're going to be treated fairly and equally, you know, that's just more appealing to me. But as my numbers grow, and it's pretty clear that we're welcomed, you can see that by our numbers, then I have a different concern. The challenge is more, how do I contribute as an individual? How do I stand out? And so then having an organization saying, don't worry, like, we value people like you here, that organization is going to be more appealing to me. And so I hear Ray and Ezra are really, really talking about inclusion failures in terms of, you know, value and diversity. Learn more about other groups. What's their logic of their social identity? Tarek is really talking about, you know, value equality. How do we treat people equally?
Yeah, and I really love the way you related it back to his experience. And I would say that, you know, tell me if you agree, we're really emphasizing value and diversity. And that goes back to what we discussed in episode 3, which is that there was a shift in the environment. And this is why things felt like you were back in the church rather than in the university, where all of a sudden you've got members of the community where maybe in the past they did have an orientation that was a little more like Tarek's. They were emphasizing value and equality with respect to their identity, and they were not interested in the university emphasizing their identity. And now all of a sudden felt like, you've got to recognize, you've got to see me and validate me. And that wasn't true before, right? And that's part of where we're coming from. But I think we agree with Tarek that, and this comes out of your research, Ray, that there's a time and a place for value and equality.
That's it.
And that's why, you know, it's part of the challenge. And so we're not disagreeing with Tarek that that's the right mode for some groups in certain circumstances. Like, in some sense, that is the ideal that universities should be striving for. Even if with respect to particular groups in particular circumstances, we might push back and say, no, no, we really do need to reach out to signal that we value you.
You're right. It's a very difficult balance as I'm thinking about our whole discussion. And is it episode 3? I can't even remember which episode it was. And when we were talking about when the student asked, where's the professor? Those were membership concerns. And I think we're emphasizing the other side because we kind of assumed that universities are past membership questions, which is clearly not true. But we think there are more past membership questions than they are, you know, being able to deal with the kinds of differences that we're seeing right now.
That's a great point, Ray, and maybe a great way to end off the season. I'm, like, you know, really hearing in my head right now a lot of conversations with a lot of colleagues here and elsewhere that make that comment one way or another. Like, there is something really, really distressing to see a lot of people almost panicked in various ways about the threat that they feel to their standing in the community or the values that they think the university represents. But the fact that they're expressing voice but not exit,
there it is.
They're committed, they're invested, is a good thing.
That's progress. I'm reminded that this is their home. We visit MIT. They live here. It's been real fun, Ezra. This has been a, you know, one episode that turned into a season. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great.